the Tenryu, Yubari, and Furutaka. These three ships were not quite ready to go home yet. They had come across the picket destroyer Ralph Talbot. When the Ralph Talbot's lookouts had seen Lieutenant Kiyose's flares to the east, the destroyer had gone to battle stations and had increased speed to 30 knots. Then, nothing. No orders were issued to her, so she simply stayed on her patrol line as she watched gunfire to the east. She still did not suspect Japanese ships were in the area until about 2:12 a.m., when a single searchlight stabbed out of the darkness on the Ralph Talbot's port bow and pinned the destroyer for about 10 seconds before swinging away. Her skipper, Lieutenant Commander Joseph W. Callahan, had no idea what that was about. The Japanese usually used two searchlights, the Americans used one, but it seemed ominous. It was even more ominous when, at 2:14 a.m., as she continued her patrol heading southwest, another single searchlight off the port beam snapped on, found the Ralph Talbot, and kept her pinned. More ominous yet were the colored shell splashes that started sprouting around her. Only Americans used colored dyes to mark the fall of their shots. Between that and the single searchlight, it must be friendly ships firing at her. Lieutenant Commander Callahan ordered the destroyer to go to top speed and start zigzagging. The Ralph Talbot turned on her identification lights and frantically broadcasted on the voice radio that she was being fired on by friendly forces. She took one hit on the starboard torpedo mount, killing two and knocking out one tube. Then, after 7 salvos, all but 2 of which were short, the shooting stopped, though the searchlight did not. Maybe her messages had gotten through. Or not. At 2:18, Lieutenant Commander Callahan saw a Japanese light cruiser, the Yubari, crossing astern headed northwest. The Ralph Talbot turned to starboard to engage, only to be pinned by the Yubari's searchlight, approximately 1,000 yards to port of the searchlight already on her from the Tenryu. Those had not been friendly ships that had been firing on her earlier, but the Tenryu and the Furutaka. Now the Furutaka unloaded with her secondary guns, while the Yubari unloaded with her main guns. In rapid succession, the Ralph Talbot took 5 hits, all from the Yubari. The first hit the chart house under the bridge and knocked out the port torpedo director and the searchlights. The second destroyed the radars and some of the fire control equipment. The third hit the wardroom, the fourth the starboard side near the torpedo tubes, causing the destroyer to ship water, and the fifth hit the No. 4 gun mount. 12 men were killed. The Ralph Talbot struggled to respond, her radars knocked out by the early hit, and her lookouts blinded by the Japanese searchlights and unable to get effective firing solutions. Lieutenant Commander Callahan launched 3 torpedoes from the functioning starboard tubes. They all missed. He swung back to port and tried to launch torpedoes, but was only able to get off 1 that missed. The Ralph Talbot thought she had gotten 1 hit on the Yubari, with which she had knocked out the cruiser's searchlight. It had not. The Yubari had merely shut it off. Lieutenant Commander Callahan no longer had a target, but he had no time to worry about that. The Ralph Talbot was a picket destroyer northwest of Savo Island, widely separated from her allied consorts. She was rapidly taking in water and quickly developed a 20-degree list to starboard. At around 2:30, she lost all power, so she couldn't move. Her radios were smashed. She was sinking, powerless, alone, and with no way to call for help. The Yubari could have finished her off, but having received Admiral Mikawa's order to withdraw, she joined the Tenryu, Yunagi, Chokai, and the 6th Cruiser Division in their headlong flight to get away from the U.S. aircraft carriers. The same U.S. aircraft carriers who were in a headlong flight to get away from the Japanese. Admiral Mikawa knew he would have to request air cover from Rabaul later in the morning, but for now, he, Captain Omai, and the flagstaff had the skippers submit their battle reports so they could assess the damage they had inflicted on the enemy. Their conclusion, 5 enemy cruisers and 4 destroyers sunk. For once, it was not that much of an exaggeration. The first warning Admiral Crutchley on the Australia had that something was amiss was when Lieutenant Kiyose's flares appeared over the transports. Like the able, experienced veteran officer he was, and unlike most of the other Allied commanders on this night, Crutchley immediately realized that the flares presaged a Japanese attack. Like those other Allied commanders, though, he misinterpreted what he was seeing, in his case still clinging to the bizarre notion that the flares were meant to aid a Japanese submarine attack on the transports. Why submarines, who rely on stealth and surprise, who hide until the right moment to make a devastating strike without warning, would want bright objects illuminating the area around them just before they strike, was never fully explained. The Admiral came to his senses once he saw gunfire south of Savo Island, gunfire that intensified as it moved north and east. The gunfire was very heavy, and I thought it must have been the Vincennes group coming into action against an enemy being engaged by the Australia group, which was correct, technically. Crutchley was puzzled as to why he had not received any reports about this engagement, but felt the lack of communications confirmed what he and Admiral Turner firmly believed, that the forces they had deployed were more than adequate to deal with the situation. Still, in an example of the better safe than sorry philosophy that had been sorely lacking in the Allies over the past 24 hours, he tried to form a battle line by moving the Australia to a blocking position some 7 miles west of the transports off Guadalcanal and ordering all destroyers not currently engaged with the enemy to form up on his flagship. A sensible action that, like most everything else the Allies did this night, went awry. Because of a communications error, most of the destroyers interpreted his order in the context of an earlier order Crutchley had issued, and instead went northwest of Savo Island, where they were completely useless for combat, but critically were able to help in rescue operations. Still having heard exactly nothing from his subordinates on the battle that had clearly taken place, but whose specifics were not clear, at 2:26 a.m., Admiral Crutchley sent out a message asking the commanders of the three screening groups, "Are your groups in action?" Admiral Scott on the San Juan, far to the east, guarding the eastern channel, answered, "This force not in action. Appears to be surface force between Florida Island and Savo." There was only an ominous silence from the Vincennes. Captain Bode on the Chicago responded, "Were, but not now." Historians may debate how Admiral Crutchley could have found fault with a battle report as complete, informative, and insightful as Captain Bode's, but apparently find fault with it he did. After seeing three burning ships between Savo and Florida Islands, at 2:42, Crutchley sent a second, much more terse message to the Chicago. "Report situation." 3 minutes later, Bode responded, "We are standing toward Lengo on course 100. Crutchley's original message had apparently caused Bode to order the Chicago to reverse course and head back to the east. Another 3 minutes went by before Bode started sketching the picture for his admiral. Chicago south of Savo Island, hit by torpedo, slightly down by bow, enemy ships firing to seaward, Canberra burning on bearing 125 degrees true, 5 miles from Savo, two destroyers standing by Canberra. It was useful information, except that Canberra was about 9 miles east of where Bode said she was, and she had no destroyers standing by her. Bode actually had no idea where they were, and seems to have just been making things up as he went along. At 3:10 a.m., a frustrated Crutchley could only report to Admiral Turner, who had seen the gun flashes and was aware that something had happened, of a surface action near Savo, situation as yet undetermined. In a missive that in the world of military reports in their dry language counts as nothing short of brutal, the Naval War College speculated that after an hour of acting as if dazed, to use Morrison's words, the demands of his immediate superior for an update had finally awakened Captain Bode to his own inglorious role in the events of this night, about which he was deeply concerned. Canberra survivor Bruce Loxton agreed, suggesting Bode was trying to cover up his conduct. That may very well be, but in fairness, one must recall the words of Captain Roskill in "Surviving the strain of trying to remain alert for several consecutive nights after long and anxious days in the deadening and exhausting heat of the Solomon Islands climate." There is also the small matter of Bode, exhausted as he was, probably not knowing if he was in charge of the Southern Force or not. Even so, he did, in what could be described as the finest military tradition, head for the sound, or at least the sight, of the gunfire, as even the War College admitted. Against that must be balanced that the two most important commodities in military actions are information and communications. Captain Bode had vital information that the Japanese were attacking, yet he did not communicate it to anyone at a time when it might have had value. He would later give multiple explanations as to why, saying he tried to and the message never got through, or, a truly bizarre defense considering the Japanese had just hit his ship with a torpedo, he did not want to give away his position to the Japanese. While he could not be bothered to communicate this vital information to anyone, Captain Bo did, in the middle of battle, find time to argue over who should be controlling the radar, which Boda turned off to again avoid giving away his position to the Japanese. When Captain Bode lacked information, specifically as to who was in charge, he did not communicate that either. While it is almost an absolute that every commander makes mistakes in every battle, and that allowances must be made for such mistakes, it is hard to find any judgmental justification for the silence from the bridge of the Chicago. Heading east toward the transports, as he probably should have been doing all along, Captain Bode stumbled across the Patterson, who, apparently without orders, took position on the Chicago's starboard bow as an anti-submarine screen. At 3:35, the lookouts sighted the Canberra, 2 miles astern. The Patterson was dropped off to assist her. The disabled and burning Australian cruiser was desperate for any and all the help she could get, but as the Patterson approached, the Canberra's ready 4-inch ammunition began to explode. "You'd better wait," she flashed the destroyer. A little after 4 a.m., the situation had cleared up enough for the Patterson to come alongside and help fight the fires and take off the wounded. Things seemed to be turning around, and then Admiral Turner sent a message. Admiral Turner was in an impossible position, but one that would nevertheless provide the mercurial but brilliant admiral one of his frequent vague moments. He knew something had happened off Savo Island, and as information came in bits and pieces, he was realizing what a disaster it was. He was furious but not surprised when he was informed that Admiral Garmley, almost in a perfunctory manner, had approved the withdrawal of Admiral Fletcher's carriers. He tried to talk Fletcher out of it, at 3:45 signaling, "Surface attack on the screen, coordinated with use of aircraft flares. Chicago hit by torpedo, Canberra on fire." For all the good that would do. Captain Sherman of the Wasp, with its pilots trained in night operations, asked Admiral Noyes 3 times to request permission from Fletcher to quickly head north to launch a strike at the fleeing Japanese ships. 3 times Noyes refused to even forward the request. He knew what the answer would be. Fletcher had never wanted a fight over Guadalcanal, and sure enough he wasn't going to fight. Which left Admiral Turner desperate to get out his unarmed and unarmored transports. At about 5 a.m., the Patterson intercepted his message, directed at Admiral Crutchley. "It is urgent for this force to depart this area at 06:30, and, if Canberra cannot join retirement in time, she should be destroyed before departure." Samuel Elliott Morrison would later call this the death warrant for the Canberra. Her crew was outraged. She was burning, she was listing 10 degrees to starboard, but she wasn't actually sinking. Now what? The Canberra's executive officer, Commander J.A. Walsh, acting as captain in place of the mortally wounded Captain Getting, kept salvage efforts going until 5:15 a.m., but as it was obvious she could not get underway in time for the 6:30 departure, he ordered the cruiser abandoned. The Patterson's Commander Walker called in the destroyer Blue to assist. Before the Blue arrived, a lookout on the Patterson reported, "Strange ship on the port quarter." The Patterson challenged the ship, but received no reply. Signaling the Canberra, "Out all lights," the destroyer cast off, to the cheers of the Australian crew. There were no outcries or entreaties, Commander Walker would later write, rather a cheery "carry on, Patterson, good luck," and prompt and efficient casting off of lines, brows, etc. Not a man stepped out of line. Walker concluded by saying everyone in the Patterson felt privileged to have served so gallant a crew. The Patterson approached the unknown ship, challenging her 2 more times. Still no reply. The destroyer snapped on her searchlight. The ship responded by opening fire. Commander Walker ordered his guns to return fire, and a snap firefight was underway. In the glare of his searchlight, Walker thought he recognized the other ship. After 3 5-inch salvos, he thought he'd better make the emergency recognition signal. The other ship, the Chicago, stopped shooting. Her jittery gunners had started shooting without orders from Captain Bode, who, now being a stickler for procedure, noted that the Patterson had used the wrong emergency identification signal. In the meantime, the destroyer Blue had managed to find the Canberra and tied up to the cruiser's port side. Now the Patterson returned, tied up to starboard, and together they removed the Canberra's survivors. Patterson would take off 398, of whom 46 were seriously wounded. Among them was Captain Getting. Emergency surgery could not stabilize him before he could be transferred to a medical transport. The Blue took 343, of whom 18 were seriously wounded. It was the Blue's only positive contribution to this Battle of Tsavo Island, or, as the Japanese called it, the First Battle of the Solomon Sea. Her battle report summed up her performance as, "This vessel took no offensive measures, inflicted no damage to enemy, and sustained no loss or damage." Or, as one historian put it, "No runs, no hits, one error." While all this was happening, at around 5:15, some good news came around. The Ralph Talbot had managed to get up some steam power and crawled close to Tsavo, where she jury-rigged her radio to send out a distress call. Meanwhile, things had gotten more complicated. Admiral Crutchley had asked the Patterson for an update on the Canberra's condition. Commander Walker responded, "Disabled on fire, in position 7 miles southeast of Tsavo." The message said it all. Except for what ship was disabled and on fire, the Canberra or the Patterson. Having heard nothing more about it, Admiral Crutchley ordered the destroyer Selfridge to check up on both the Canberra and the Patterson, and to sink both if they could not join the retirement. Meanwhile, General Vandegrift reported to Admiral Turner that only 3 days of rations and 36 hours of ammunition had been landed at Tulagi. He pleaded with Turner to allow 6 more hours for the transports to unload critical supplies. Turner agreed, and at 6:21 a.m. canceled its original order for withdrawal. The Selfridge was continuing toward the Canberra when she stumbled across the Astoria, disabled, burning, if anything, in even worse shape than the Canberra. At 6:44, the destroyer reported the cruiser's position and that 4 destroyers were trying to pick up survivors. This was the first news that Admiral Crutchley or Admiral Turner had on the Northern Group. Turner would add that he had no information on the Vincennes. The Quincy and Ralph Talbot were believed sunk, and the Astoria was burning, but the crew was trying to save the ship. Having passed the Astoria, the Selfridge finally arrived at the Canberra, finding the Australian cruiser deserted. Her skipper asked Admiral Turner if she should continue with scuttling the Canberra. Even though he had delayed the evacuation of the transports, the very reason why the Canberra had to be sunk, Turner quickly said she should. So at 7:10, the Selfridge opened fire with her 5-inch guns on the derelict. But nothing came easy on this day. The destroyer Ellet came along and saw the Selfridge shooting at a cruiser. She assumed it must be a Japanese cruiser, so the Ellet opened fire as well. She had fired 106 5-inch rounds and seen several hits before the Selfridge could break the bad news that she was shooting at a friendly ship. Even so, the Canberra still wouldn't sink. The Selfridge fired 263 5-inch rounds. She launched 4 torpedoes, only one of which exploded, another fine performance for U.S. torpedoes. At 7:47, the frustrated destroyer called on the Ellet to finish the job. At close range, the Ellet fired 1 torpedo, which really did explode against the Canberra's starboard side, and the cruiser sank at 8 a.m., which left the Astoria. The cruiser was, for all practical purposes, divided in two, with the bow and stern not burning, but everything in between an inferno so intense that no ship could come alongside. The destroyer Bagley, with Lieutenant Commander Chambers conning in this awkward situation, put her starboard bow along the Astoria's starboard bow. By 4:45 a.m., she had taken off all wounded from the forecastle. Then she saw a light flashing from the stern. Survivors were there, too, so she headed there, in the process picking up survivors, some of whom were from the Vincennes, in rafts and in the water. At about 5:45, the Bagley returned, and Lieutenant Commander Chambers brought the ship to the Astoria's starboard quarter. Captain Greeman believed that even though she had a 3-degree list to port, the cruiser could still be saved. He went back aboard with 325 men. They set up a bucket brigade to try to douse the intense fires. Lieutenant Commander Topper took a damage control team to try poking around the lower decks. At around 7 a.m., the old four-piper destroyer Hopkins, now a minesweeper, came up to help. Captain Greeman asked the Hopkins to tow her to the shallow water off Guadalcanal so they could effect more repairs and hopefully keep those gaping holes in the port side from submerging. The burning, waterlogged heavy cruiser was really too much for the old destroyer to manage, but after a fashion they made a tow line and got the Astoria pointed southeast. Morale soared as they slowly built up speed, soon moving at 3 knots. And they needed to get moving. At around 8:50 a.m., word spread that a coast watcher on Bougainville had heard a large formation of aircraft headed southeast. The Japanese were on the way. Captain Greenman reported to Admiral Turner that there was a chance of saving the Astoria if she could get power and water to fight the fires. At the order of Turner, the destroyer Wilson, and her one known useful act in this action, came alongside the cruiser shortly thereafter to pump water into the fire. Between the Wilson and the Bucket Brigade, they were slowly whittling down the fire, except for a very intense one below decks near the wardroom. Nevertheless, things were slowly turning for the worse. The list had increased to 10 degrees. Lieutenant Commander Topper could not ascertain whether the sprinkler system and flooding valves had been able to flood the forward 5-inch magazine. Captain Greenman believed they had not, but because of fires and damage, no one could get there to check. The answer to their question came at 11 a.m., more felt than heard. A big shudder came from the ship, followed by the grind of collapsing bulkheads, all in the vicinity of the number 2 turret. Yellow gas bled out of the shell holes. Topper tried to get down a hatch to the forward 5-inch handling room, but the hatch was too hot. Another rumble, more crashes from collapsing bulkheads. The magazines were exploding. It was over. At 11:19, Admiral Turner ordered the Hopkins and Wilson away to begin escorting the transports leaving Guadalcanal, but he was sending the Buchanan to help fight the fires and the transport El Chiba to tow the ship. Yet all they could do was pick up survivors. The port list was enough so the shell holes started shipping water. The explosions below decks were venting out the ship. At 5 minutes past noon, Captain Greenman bowed to the inevitable and ordered the Astoria abandoned. She rolled over to port and sank by the bow at 12:15, joining the Canberra, Quincy, and Vincennes on the bottom of what would thereafter be known as Iron Bottom Sound. Except for an intermission preparing for the Japanese air attack, that, strangely, never came, Admiral Turner kept the transports unloading for those additional 6 hours, for as much room as they could free up by unloading food, ammunition, and other supplies for the Marines on Guadalcanal was as much room as they had for the wounded. Why he placed so much effort on saving the American Astoria, but not the similarly situated Australian Canberra, is a question Turner never answered. But the discrepancy, perceived or otherwise, would be a source of friction between the American and Australian governments. Nevertheless, in acceding to General Vandegrift's wishes, Admiral Turner had been exceedingly courageous in exposing himself and his men to Japanese air attacks for which they had little defense, but they could not stay exposed. Beginning at 4 p.m. and ending at dusk, the Allied ships left in 3 convoys. It was the start of the first Allied offensive of the Pacific War, but it felt like a retreat from Moscow, no mean feat in the South Pacific. 4 first-line cruisers sunk, 1,077 American and Australian sailors dead in the worst defeat in U.S. Navy history. The mood was glum. "It was a big mess," said Fred Tuchito of the Chicago. "We had no idea that the Japanese were so good." Admiral King would call it the blackest day of the whole war. About an hour after dawn on August 9th, an SBD Dauntless from the carrier Saratoga was out scouring the Coral Sea southwest of Guadalcanal for any sign of the Japanese. Not to attack them, of course, but to make sure they were not following. The crew did not find any Japanese, but did find something curious all the same. The bright blue Coral Sea was marred by a long rainbow coming from a small ship. The Dauntless approached. The ship was friendly, a U.S. destroyer, but she appeared to be in dreadful shape. She was inching along at about 7 knots, down by the bow and trailing that rainbow, a large oil slick. The air crew radioed in the contact and the grim picture it presented, not even knowing the half of it. The ship was the destroyer Jarvis, who, in the previous day's air attack, had suffered a torpedo hit that left a 50-foot hole in her starboard bow. The attack had knocked out her radios. Most of her guns were disabled. All of her lifeboats, torpedoes, and floatables had been jettisoned. The SBD resumed her mission and left the Jarvis. The destroyer was barely clinging to life all alone in the middle of the broad expanse of water between Guadalcanal and Australia. No way to contact anyone, but at least the Americans now knew where she was. And so did the Japanese. While escaping the U.S. carrier planes that had no intention of attacking him, Admiral Mikawa had reviewed the battle reports from his skippers. He found the action report of the destroyer Yunagi intriguing. She had damaged one Achilles-class cruiser trying to escape in the outer bay. When Mikawa radioed Admiral Yamada of the 5th Air Attack Force in Rabaul, requesting air cover, he also told him about the cruiser. Admiral Yamada was already taking action. He had launched his own reconnaissance planes around dawn to see what they could of the Allies around Tulagi and Guadalcanal, and to find those elusive American aircraft carriers. One Betty bomber of the 4th Air Group reported at 9:35 a.m., that it had spotted a large enemy destroyer some 100 miles southwest of Tulagi. At 11 a.m., a second Betty of the 4th Air Group reported sighting a damaged Achilles-class cruiser slowly retiring from the battle area. Now here was a nice target, a cruiser. Undoubtedly the same ship reported as the large enemy destroyer earlier, hurt and limping away. Shortly before 8 a.m., Admiral Yamada had already launched 16 bombers of the Misawa Air Group and 15 Zeros of the Tainan Air Group and sent them toward Guadalcanal, likely to attack the transports, who, unbeknown to him, were now without fighter protection, or better yet, to find those American carriers. Yamada decided to go for the quick, almost certain kill. At about 11:16, he ordered the Betty from the 4th Air Group to maintain its station over the cruiser and redirected the 31 aircraft already in the air to that position, with the primary assignment to attack enemy cruiser. At 1 p.m., they found their badly wounded prey, not an Achilles-class light cruiser, but the destroyer Jarvis. As one historian put it, her crew had no boats, no life rafts, and no chance. The knowledge of imminent death often has a way of focusing the mind, and, in the case of the Jarvis, the eyes of her gunners. Like a wounded animal caught in a trap, the destroyer growled and snapped at her tormentors. Despite the Zeros strafing her decks to try to keep her gunners down, her anti-aircraft fire seems to have been unusually effective, as she shot down two Bettys and damaged four more, one so badly it had to make an emergency landing. But with 16 torpedoes aimed at a destroyer that could barely move, the issue was never in doubt. Admiral Yamada would later dryly record, "Results, attacked and sank one Achilles-type ship." No way to call for help, no lifeboats, no one friendly anywhere near her, all alone. Any survivors of the Jarvis 264 officers and men were doomed to drown in the Coral Sea. Trying to swim in the midst of a nauseating oil slick until they could swim no more, then sinking into the cold depths forever. As far as the U.S. Navy knew, they had just vanished. Even by the impossibly dark standards of war, the fate of the Jarvis and her crew was a unique twist on absolute hell. But an absolute hell that saved the lives of perhaps thousands of American and Australian servicemen on Guadalcanal by diverting from them an air attack against which they themselves were largely unprotected. Pleasantly surprised that he had not encountered an air attack on his return trip, Admiral Mikawa entered Simpson Harbor in the Chokai with the 18th Cruiser Division and the Yunagi at 5:39 a.m. on August 10th. His flag was struck from the luxurious flagship and raised back above the dump of a building next to the Lakunai airfield. The admiral, who had been unwanted in Rabaul, was now greeted with cheers, with which the soft-spoken Mikawa could not have been entirely comfortable. Yet the cheers were well-earned. This operation had been assembled on the fly, with ships that had never worked together, with only the barest amount of information concerning the enemy, and no air cover. Yet through the planning and skill of Admiral Mikawa and his crews, and through pushing their luck to its absolute limit, and maybe even past it, they had inflicted on the U.S. Navy the worst defeat in its history, with barely a scratch in return, relatively speaking. The only thing that went wrong the previous night was the reinforcement convoy Mikawa had slapped together. Some 14 miles west of Cape St. George, the Mayo Maru took two torpedoes into her port side aft, compliments of Lieutenant Commander Munson and the U.S. submarine S-38, eager to make up for being unable to attack Mikawa's cruisers. The transport went down just after 8 p.m., taking down with her 342 of the Special Naval Landing Force troops and 31 of her crew. Escorts Tsugaru and minesweeper W-21 counterattacked, but Munson's boat made good her escape. Yet compared with Mikawa's tactical success of that same night, it was merely an inconvenience. When Mikawa stepped ashore, he even found a message from Admiral Yamamoto waiting for him. It read, "Appreciate the courageous and hard fighting of every man of your organization. I expect you to expand your exploits, and you will make every effort to support the land forces of the Imperial Army, which are now engaged in a desperate struggle." A nice message on the surface, but the reference to the land forces of the Imperial Army's desperate struggle, in that oblique way that is so Japanese, recalled the transports of the U.S. land forces that Admiral Mikawa had not attacked. Privately, Yamamoto was furious with Mikawa. For now, though, there was cause for celebration, a celebration badly needed after the catastrophe of Midway. The Chokai was being repaired by the 8th Base Force. Mikawa hoped his men could get some rest and relaxation in Rabaul, and he hoped for celebration, rest, and relaxation for the men of the 6th Cruiser Division, whom he had ordered up to Kavieng with no destroyer escort the previous morning. Most of them would get that rest and relaxation. Admiral Goto and the men of the 6th Cruiser Division were indeed in a celebratory mood. Having escaped air attack off Guadalcanal, they had just escaped submarine attack in the natural choke point of the St. George's Channel between New Britain and New Ireland. Yesterday they thought they had spotted a periscope in the channel, wrongly, as it turned out, and had to endure a night of evasive maneuvers. But they had left the channel with its submarine threat behind them, and dawn had produced a bright, sunny day. With dawn, Goto had ordered the zigzagging stopped, and now the Aoba led her consorts in a column at 16 knots. With the beautiful weather present, and combat unlikely, the skippers were allowed to open the portholes of their ships to vent out the stifling heat below decks. They were some 16 miles off Simberi Island. Kavieng was less than 100 miles away. At 9:10 a.m., there was an underwater explosion, and a huge geyser of water erupted abreast the number one forward turret on the starboard side of the last cruiser in the column, the Kako. Within seconds, there were two more explosions and aquatic eruptions on her starboard side further aft, in the vicinity of the forward magazines and boiler rooms 1 and 2. Maybe they had stopped those evasive maneuvers a little too soon, for the explosions were from 3 torpedoes out of a spread of 4 launched by the 17-year-old U.S. submarine S-44, stewing off New Ireland under the command of Lieutenant Commander John R. Dinty Moore. The range had been a ludicrously close 700 yards. "We were close enough to see the Japs on the bridge using their glasses," Moore later said. Within 3 minutes, the Kako groaned as her bow dipped from the first hit and twisted, letting water ship in through those open portholes, another great idea implemented just a tad too soon. The dying cruiser continued rolling over onto her starboard side, her holes big and small, sucking in more and more water, her forward stack belching steam. Having dived to 130 feet, the 850-ton S-44 could only listen to what followed as the cold seawater reached the Kako's boilers. "Evidently all her boilers blew up," Moore recalled. "You could hear hideous noises, like steam hissing through water. These noises were more terrifying to the crew than the actual depth charges that followed. It sounded as if giant chains were being dragged across our hull, as if our own water and airlines were bursting." Just some 7 minutes after the first torpedo had hit, just short of the safety of Kavieng, the Kako sank bow first, 8,800 tons gone, just like that. Their luck from Savo Island had definitely run out. Admiral Goto and the other ships of the 6th Cruiser Division tried to find the undersea predator in their midst. The Aoba cryptically recorded, "Carried out embarrassing depth charge barrage." The S-44 escaped rather easily, having bagged the largest ship sunk by U.S. submarines so far in the Pacific War. Perhaps now a little more conscious of the threat from submarines, the remnants of the 6th Cruiser Division spent most of the rest of the day picking up survivors. The destroyer Uzuki came up from Mabal to rescue a few more the next day. Ultimately, the vast majority of the Kako's crew, including her skipper, Captain Takahashi Yuji, were rescued, but 34 crewmen were lost. The arrival of the Aoba, Furutaka, and Kinugasa in Kavieng at 5:11 that afternoon was not nearly the happy one they had expected. The Kako was a Parthian shot from a foe who had already been defeated. defeated in battle, but not the war. This was no longer the Philippines, the Java Sea, the Indian Ocean, when the Imperial Japanese Navy could steamroll its enemies, usually without taking losses, often before the enemies could even organize to fight. No more. Now their enemies fought hard. Now even a victory for the Imperial Japanese Navy came with a price they could not afford to pay. How times had changed. How Midway had changed everything. Chapter 4 Pandemonium. Marooned. That was the feeling running through the 1st Marine Division. Having all of their transports and cargo ships up anchor and leave, carrying most of their supplies with no definite time frame as to when they would be back, can leave one with that feeling. The Marines were shocked, a feeling intensified by news of the disaster at Tsavo Island. Marooned. On a jungle island, holding only a tiny part of a jungle island, shared with the enemy. Almost all of the Marines' heavy equipment had been on the cargo ships at whose defense Admiral Fletcher had balked. The Marines had enough food for maybe 37 days, enough ammunition for just 4 days of combat. General Vandegrift called his senior officers for a briefing on the situation. I told them of Fletcher's carriers precipitately retiring, which meant that the transports were leaving. Less than half of our supply was on the beach. All of our heavy equipment remained aboard the transports. God only knew when we could expect aircraft protection, much less surface craft. With the transports gone, the enemy would shift his attacks against us, and we could expect surface attacks as well. Then I ordered them to relate these unsavory facts to their junior officers, NCOs, and men. But they must also pound home that we anticipated no Bataan, no Wake Island. Since 1775, Marines had found themselves in tough spots. They had survived, and we would survive. But only if every officer and man on Guadalcanal gave his all to the cause. Lieutenant Colonel Twining described their predicament. We were left without exterior communications or support of any kind, and with no assurance that help would be forthcoming. We had no source of information or observation, except what we could derive from a 24-foot observation tower constructed of palm logs inherited from the Emperor. We were on half rations, had little ammunition, and no construction equipment or defensive materials whatsoever, and no one would talk to us when we improvised a long-distance transmitter from captured Japanese radio equipment. Outside of that, we were in great shape. The Marines got to work, finishing the airfield, establishing a defense perimeter around it, and lugging the dropped-off supplies to hidden caches. It was now that the Marines really got to know Guadalcanal. It might be hard to imagine Guadalcanal. People hear South Pacific, and they think sun and lots of it, palm trees, beaches, and the like. Guadalcanal sounds like a virtual paradise, except with people shooting at you. Many English speakers, not versed in history, find it shocking that Guadalcanal does not have an actual canal. The very name suggests a fundamental dishonesty about the island. The island, as many a writer has opined, looks like paradise, but is more like paradise lost. The Marines quickly picked up on the dishonesty, that Guadalcanal was a lie. William Manchester called it a vision of beauty, but of evil beauty. Remembering how Guadalcanal looked from the deck of a transport on D-Day, one Marine said, "From our vantage point, we couldn't see what a putrefying shithole it really was." Before the American invasion, information on the Solomons was sorely lacking. The Europeans first discovered the Solomons in 1568, and various European powers made efforts to colonize the Solomons, along with New Britain and New Georgia, which is how the island names seemed like little pieces of European imperialism tossed into a pot and shaken, not stirred. But with no riches, hostile natives, and an unpleasant climate, no one particularly wanted to go there, so the islands were largely forgotten. The Australians preferred to pretend the Solomons weren't there. Those few who had been there usually refused to talk about them. The very few who did talk about them, who had visited Guadalcanal, called it a bloody stinking hole. Mostly volcanic in origin, if not current behavior, the Solomons are largely a double column of islands running from northwest to southeast. To the northwest, the large island of Bougainville, itself bracketed by Buka to the northwest, and Shortland, the name of an island and its associated island group, to the southeast, acts as a block in the big channel between the double line of islands, technically called New Georgia Sound, but known in American parlance for obvious reasons as the Slot. The major islands on the north-northeast side of the Slot are, from northwest to southeast, Choiseul, Santa Isabel, and Mileta. On the south-southwest side of the Slot are New Georgia and associated islands around it, the Russell Islands, Guadalcanal, and San Cristobal. The centerpiece of the campaign, Guadalcanal, is some 90 miles in length and about 25 miles wide. On the other side of the newly and unhappily named Iron Bottom Sound, between Guadalcanal and Mileta, was the island of Florida, and snuggled into an elbow of Florida Island and Iron Bottom Sound was Tulagi, home of the best natural harbor in the Lower Solomons. Also between Guadalcanal and Florida, off the northwest corner of Guadalcanal, was Savo Island, tiny and conical, albeit not sharply so. The Indispensable Strait, named after a British warship, separates Florida from neighboring Mileta. The strait between Florida and Guadalcanal to the south, part of Iron Bottom Sound, is known generally as Sea Lark Channel. The Marines had no idea what they had gotten themselves into. As official U.S. Navy historian Samuel Elliott Morrison explained, the Marines, usually prepared to land anywhere at any time, possessed information on almost every group of Pacific islands except the Solomons. This should probably have been a tip-off that the decisive Pacific campaign would be fought there. There was information out there, however, if one knew where to look and whom to ask. Coast watcher Martin Clemens described Guadalcanal. On the inside, she was a poisonous morass. Crocodiles hid in her creeks or patrolled her turgid backwaters. Her jungles were alive with slithering, crawling, scuttling things, with giant lizards that barked like dogs, with huge red furry spiders, with centipedes and leeches and scorpions, with rats and bats and fiddler crabs and one big species of land crab, which moved through the bush with all the stealth of a steamroller. The first thing one notices about Guadalcanal is the heat. And it's not a dry heat. The air is completely saturated. The public affairs officer, Major Frank O. Huff, described it, saying, "No air stirs here, and the hot humidity is beyond the imagination of anyone who has not lived in it." The Solomons have two seasons, wet and dry, though to the Marines the seasons were more like wet and really wet. The New York Times' F. Tillman Durden wrote, "It rains almost every night, weepy tropical rain that soaks into the bedrolls and seeps through the tarpaulin. The nights are passed in wet chill and discomfort, and the days in mud and filth." Marine Captain Joe Foss said the foxholes where most of each night was spent never dried out and smelled like an owl's nest, a description to which probably everyone can relate. The rain has more of a negative effect than just wetness, mud, and general discomfort. It feeds the primordial jungle and keeps it primordial. The jungle canopy combines with the dense undergrowth to keep much of the jungle floor in darkness for years, decades, centuries. Anything that dies, plant or animal, in that damp darkness rots, in ghastly, horrifying, nauseating fashion. Rot lies everywhere just under the exotic lushness, explained Major Huff. The ground is porous with decaying vegetation, emitting a sour, unpleasant odor. Freshly killed flesh begins to decompose in a matter of a few hours. William Manchester listed a few of the enemies American forces had to face. Serpents, crocodiles, centipedes which could crawl across the flesh, leaving a trail of swollen skin, land crabs which would scuttle in the night, making noises indistinguishable from those of an infiltrating Jap, scorpions, lizards, tree leeches, cockatoos that screamed like the leader of a bonsai charge, wasps as long as your finger, and spiders as large as your fist, and mosquitoes, 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 all carriers of malaria. But it wasn't just the mosquitoes and the malaria. The standing water also bred mold and other unfriendly microbes that permeated the air and got into every wound, every scratch, and turned them into malignant ulcers. Private Leckie called them Guadalcanal rot, an exceedingly painful type of tropical ulcer or jungle rot. The travel writer Jack London described them in The Cruise of the Snark as excessively active ulcers, A mosquito bite, a cut, or the slightest abrasion serves for the lodgment of the poison with which the air seems to be filled. One Marine described the ulcers as flesh encrusted with oozing pus by the canteen cup, and those ulcers easily turned septic. One could lose a limb from jungle rot. The constant rain also played havoc with equipment. Vehicles got stuck in deep mud, anything metal rusted, electrical circuits and batteries were disrupted, and it was impossible to keep oneself clean through all this with no clean place to shower or shave or wash clothes with any regularity, especially since most of the personal care items had been on those cargo ships Admiral Fletcher would not protect. Indeed, with most of the toilet paper stashed aboard those cargo ships, Marines who had to use the toilet cleaned themselves with pages from the New York Times. Between the mud, the mold, and the men unable to bathe or wash, the smell was nauseating. Even the plants were unfriendly, particularly the notorious kunai grass, also called blood grass because the tips can be the color of blood and can draw blood. Kunai can grow to a height of 7 feet or so. It is stiff, serrated, and sharp. Manchester said kunai could lay a man's hand open as quickly as a scalpel. But kunai was just the vanguard of botany's assault on humanity. Most of the island that was not kunai was what historian William J. Owens called pestilential rainforest. Massive trees, sometimes 40 feet across at their base, were often dead and rotten, liable to topple at the merest disturbance. There were at least 11 kinds of thorn bushes and vines with large, razor-sharp thorns like hooks that rip through uniforms and human flesh. Bamboo, which according to Private Richard William Harding, seemed to grow even as it was hacked down. The rain, the rot, the mosquitoes, the malaria, the kunai. Then there were the animals, poisonous snakes, bats that can foul any exposed food, saltwater crocodiles. It was this South Pacific paradise in which the 1st Maroon Division, as Lieutenant Colonel Twining cheekily renamed the unit, got to work. The supplies were hauled off the beach and dispersed among small caches hidden in the jungle and inside the perimeter. Within 4 days, most of it was completed. Engineers improved the old coastal road to Lunga and bridged various waterways inside the perimeter to speed movement. There was one piece of good news for General Vandegrift and his men. Some of the Japanese had left in a panic. Others thought the Americans were just going to raid the island and so decided to hide out until the Americans left. In both cases, the Japanese had left everything behind, including hot meals sitting on tables. Most of what the U.S. could not supply for the time being, due to pulling out the transports too soon, the Japanese did, including huge quantities of rice, plums, tinned crab meat, and other foods. Also beer and sake, useful since he couldn't drink the local water. A complete radio suite, which, since there had not been time to get the radios off the transports, was a godsend that, with some tinkering, allowed them to communicate. 34 operational trucks, numerous bicycles, a 1940 Plymouth, and a headquarters building shaped like a pagoda, which became the U.S. headquarters and was nicknamed, unsurprisingly, the Pagoda. Even rifles, machine guns, ammunition, basic earth-moving equipment, and 2 functional radar sets were all salvaged. The Marines set up their defensive perimeter, some 9,600 yards in length. In the east, the line was the waterway east of the airfield, which the Marines had dubbed Alligator Creek. Even though it did not have alligators and was not a creek, it was actually the Elu River, even though it was not a river but a tidal lagoon. The Marines kept confusing it with the Tenaru River, further east, on the other side of thick jungle. This part of the line was held by the 1st Marine Regiment, as was the beach all around Lunga Point. On the west side, the perimeter looped around the village of Kukum, across the flat land between the beach and the hills, and was held by the 5th Marine Regiment, except for one battalion. The perimeter was thin. Most of the combat forces were held inland as a reserve to counter any penetration of the line. The line to the south of the airfield, facing the interior jungle, was especially thin, and mainly outposted, since it was believed this was the least likely direction from which an attack would come. The Marines were able to sprinkle the perimeter with artillery. The 1st Special Weapons Battalion placed its 75mm half-tracks inland from the beach, but could move them on the beach if necessary. The 11th Marine Regiment deployed its 75mm PAC howitzers and 100mm howitzers around the airfield, but they had not been able to unload their 155mm howitzers. The 3rd Defense Battalion placed their 90mm anti-aircraft guns within the perimeter, but they had not been able to unload their 5-inch coastal defense guns. The absence of both the 155s and the coastal defense guns would prove painful in the days ahead. Outside of this perimeter, infantry patrolled the jungles and started tangling with Japanese defenders almost immediately. Captain Monzen had originally planned to launch a suicide attack against the Marine invaders, but with the pitiful amount of men he had been able to scrounge up, he figured such a venture would be all suicide and no attack, so he melted back into the jungle. He then started forming the core of Japanese resistance between the Matanako River, some 4 miles west of Lunga, and Kokumbona, a native village some 4 miles west of that. Most importantly, while this was going on, the 1st Engineer Battalion completed the airstrip. This was no mean feat, since the cargo ship Fomelo, which had been carrying most of the earth-moving equipment, had left after offloading only about 15% of her cargo. The cargo that made it ashore included no power shuffles or dump trucks, and only one bulldozer. That's where the earth-moving equipment left behind by the Japanese, primitive as it was, came in most helpful, especially the 2 small trains with hoppers that were able to cart off some 7,000 cubic feet of earth. General Vandegrift reported that the new airfield could handle 38 fighters and 9 dive bombers. It was on August 10th or so when General Vandegrift had a small but quite meaningful ceremony. Major Weir had taken a small American flag from a disabled landing boat. Then the resourceful air officer scrounged up a Japanese flagpole, asking the general to come to the pagoda for the first flag raising over the new airfield. But a new airfield, a new base, needs a name. Major Weir didn't want it named after some pot-bellied old SOB behind a desk in the Pentagon. He thought of one Marine named Major Lofton R. Henderson. Joe Henderson, as he was sometimes called, had been the commanding officer of Marine Scout Bombing Squadron 241, which had been stationed at Midway during the pivotal battle. He bravely led 16 SBD Dauntlesses flown by inexperienced Marine pilots without fighter escort in a dangerous glide-bombing attack on the Japanese carrier Hiryu. Zeros and anti-aircraft fire cut them to ribbons. Flying in the lead to calm his green air crews, Henderson was the first shot down, his left wing set afire, he himself badly wounded over the Hiryu. He was never seen again. Henderson was the first Marine aviator killed in an attack on the enemy. In his honor, Major Weir, endorsed by General Vandegrift, christened the new runway Henderson Field. The head of the Japanese Naval General Staff, Admiral Nagano Osami, stood in his dress whites before his emperor. Answering questions about the American attacks on Guadalcanal and Tulagi, Nagano was firm. "It is nothing worthy of your majesty's attention." That answer did not itself seem worthy of his majesty. Not when the man giving the answer, Admiral Nagano, had traveled all the way to the emperor's summer villa in Nikko to brief him on the Guadalcanal situation in order to short-circuit the emperor's own plans to return to Tokyo upon hearing about the attack. Admiral Nagano went on to explain, "It was only a raid, nothing more. Their information was that only 2,000 American troops were on Guadalcanal, there only to destroy the airfield and leave." The Japanese military attaché in Moscow had received this information directly from the Russians. Exactly how the Russians would have known is rather vague, and apparently not an issue the Japanese considered. It was what the Japanese wanted to hear. "Don't worry, Your Majesty," Admiral Nagano concluded. "The landing is a reconnaissance. We can push them off with just our naval landing force. There would be danger if we let them consolidate, so we will move quickly to mount an operation against them. Please set your mind at rest and stay there." The emperor's mind was not at rest, however. Nor were some of the minds at Imperial General Headquarters and elsewhere. The Army Operations Section was questioning the interpretation that this was a mere raid, based on reports of a large convoy having left San Francisco in mid-July that correlated with a large number of transports sighted off Lunga. Those transports suggested to Admiral Mikawa's 8th Fleet that the Americans had landed a full division. Nevertheless, General Yakutake's 17th Army resisted the interpretation that the landings on Guadalcanal and Tulagi represented a new Allied offense, unwilling to be distracted from his desire to take Port Moresby. In fairness, however, the Imperial Army's belief that the invasion was likely a raid, and could not be more than a few thousand troops, was based largely on the assessment that the Pacific Fleet could not mount an offensive before 1943. That assessment was based on the Naval General Staff's report of U.S. losses at Midway. It was an assessment which deliberately overstated those losses, to put it mildly. In effect, the Naval General Staff had lied to the Imperial Army about the extent of the disaster at Midway. In the meantime, the Japanese were taking some action. Admiral Tsukahara, as previously arranged, headed to Rabaul to take over naval operations in the South Pacific as Southeast Area Commander. Under his command was Admiral Mikawa's 8th Fleet and his own 11th Air Fleet, the latter now operationally titled Base Air Force. Under Base Air Force was the 5th Air Attack Force, 25th Air Flotilla, which was supposed to be rotated out and replaced with the 6th Air Attack Force, 26th Air Flotilla. Now, because of the developments on Guadalcanal and Tulagi, the 6th would instead be reinforcing the 5th. The 6th consisted of two groups of medium bombers, the Misawa and Kisarazu air groups, and one group of fighters from the 6th Air Group. The 5th still had the star-studded veteran Tainan Air Group of fighters, plus the 4th Air Group of medium bombers, depleted by their disastrous attack on Guadalcanal on August 8th. The seaplanes of the Yokohama and 14th Air Groups, and the fighters and carrier bombers of the 2nd Air Group. All told, Base Air Force had about 114 aircraft on hand. It was Base Air Force's aerial reconnaissance that showed little activity at the Lunga airfield and no aircraft. It was Admiral Mikawa's 8th Fleet, whose destroyers ran sweeps of Tsavo Sound, where they found no evidence of American activity. These efforts buttressed the idea that the landings were small-scale, which is exactly what everyone wanted to believe. Admiral Nagano and General Sugiyama Hajime, his chief of staff counterpart for the Army, reached an agreement on August 10th concerning operations in New Guinea and the Solomons. Port Moresby, New Guinea, was still to be the ultimate objective in the South Pacific, but now General Hyakutake's 17th Army would first retake Guadalcanal and Tulagi. It was an annoyance to General Hyakutake. He considered Guadalcanal and Tulagi to be insignificant. He neither needed nor wanted them to suck resources off his main goal of taking Port Moresby. As it was, his command of the 17th Army came with a caveat some assembly required, since reinforcements intended for his command were strewn across the Pacific and Southeast Asia. The 2nd Sendai Division was divided between Java and the Philippines. The 38th Nagoya Division was in the East Indies. The 35th Brigade under General Kawaguchi Kiyotake was in the Palau Islands. The 28th Regiment from the 7th Division under Colonel Ichiki Kiyonao was on Guam. Various anti-tank units were scattered hither and yon, some even in Manchuria. Where General Hyakutake saw a burden, Admiral Yamamoto saw an opportunity. An opportunity to avenge Midway and bring about the decisive battle with the Americans that he had always wanted. Yamamoto assembled a fleet of 5 aircraft carriers, 4 battleships, 16 cruisers, 1 seaplane tender, and 30 destroyers. Once again, he could have just assembled an armada and advanced, but that was just not the Imperial Japanese Navy way. No, the Imperial Japanese Navy way was, once again, to divide the fleet into bite-sized pieces for purposes of deception. It had not worked at Coral Sea. It had not worked, most famously, at Midway. But Yamamoto was certain it would work eventually. So, on August 11th, Admiral Yamamoto started moving the pieces into place as the 2nd Fleet, under Vice Admiral Kondo Nobutake, designated the advance force, went to sea. It consisted of the 4th Cruiser Division, with the heavy cruisers Otago also serving as Kondo's flagship, her sister ship Takao, and her other sister ship Maya. The fleet also had the 5th Cruiser Division, under Vice Admiral Takagi Takeo, the victor of the Battle of the Java Sea, with the heavy cruisers Myoko and Haguro. All were screened by the 4th Destroyer Flotilla, under Rear Admiral Takama Tamotsu, with the light cruiser Yura as his flagship, and destroyers Kuroshio, Hoyashio, Hayashio, Minegumo, Natsugumo, and Asagumo. Air cover would be provided by the seaplane tender Chitose, It was part of a new three-pronged operational strategy being tried out in the aftermath of Midway. In addition to the advance force, there was also the vanguard force, which would screen the reconstituted slimmer Kido Butai until the former was ordered to move ahead of the carriers. The vanguard force was under Rear Admiral Abe Hiroaki, with Kido Butai's traditional escort battleships, Hiei, serving as Abe's flagship, and Kirishima, as well as the hybrid heavy cruiser seaplane carrier Chikuma from the 8th Cruiser Division, and